Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Well, Dan, our next guest is someone I'm really glad to say I found at one of those shows that they put on for journalists. She's Joanne Tilghman. She's the founder of Granny Joe, a company that specializes on products, I say, for golden agers. I don't know if she'll say that, but she's a fascinating woman with a fascinating company. Joanne, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Joanne, tell us what your company's all about and your website before we do anything else.
Sure. The business we started about 10 years ago is Granny Joe Products, and probably more so than Golden Agers, we like to think of it as that we manufacture and produce items for sassy seniors. Seniors that are looking for something with style and fashion sense that make their lives a little easier. And it's an interesting market because not too many people are focused on what seniors need outside of the medical portion of what seniors need. And our website is www.grannyjoeproducts.com. And
spell it out.
It's GrannyJoeProducts, GrannyJoeProducts.com.
Well, you know, what fascinated me, Joanne, is that you have a cup that people can, that older people can hold with both hands. That's what was there. Tell us about that and how that came about, and then we'll turn it over to Dan.
Sure. We call our two-handled mug our dignity mug because we believe that it allows people to hold on to their dignity a little bit longer. Steps down in life are always difficult to take, and anything that can delay taking downward steps is a plus. I came up with that product actually for my mother-in-law who had Alzheimer's. And I was having breakfast with my in-laws, and my mother-in-law was trying to figure out why her mug only had one handle. And I sort of flippantly said to my father-in-law, oh, I'll go online and I'll find her a mug with two handles and I'll send it to you. And at that time, 10 years ago, I really couldn't find anything beyond the plastic sippy cup for a toddler that was, you know, had two handles. And fortunately for me, at that particular point in time, I had a son who was a global sourcing vice president and had contacts around the world. And I said, you know, do you know anybody who can make me a mug with two handles? And 24 hours later, I had a picture of our dignity mug. And since then, we have added other variations of the same mug with two handles. Because there are a lot of people who have had a stroke, who have tremors, have arthritis, just don't have the hand or arm strength any longer to handle something with one handle. So we have our mug with two handles that we know helps people.
Off to you, Dan.
Well, Joanne, thank you for coming. I went to your website to look at all the things that you have, and it's an amazing website. And what impressed me the most is the dignity in which you display your products to a population that's right now about 15% of the total population of the country and growing rapidly.
Absolutely.
And so you're providing products. Have you thought about
I have written a book on dementia, and I mm-hmm. have become much more aware of the challenges with people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And do you have a research capability that you can meet with people who are suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's and see it, and do the products potentially show up? How do you find your next product?
You know, I get asked that question quite a bit. And I would have to say at this particular point in time, products come from my head. And that sounds kind of strange. But I watch people. We live in Florida, so you can go almost anywhere and watch people. I mean, not as a voyeur, but, you know, just out in general. And you can get a pretty good idea of some of the things that people are struggling with. People want dignity. They want independence. There's a, you know, this whole thrust of aging in place, which is, you know, very popular and a very, you know, trendy sort of buzzword. But people want to stay home as long as possible. And we try to help people to do that. But I have had some focus groups at some assisted living facilities with probably more in line with any sort of research. I wouldn't say I do research specifically, but between watching people and talking to people, we generate ideas from there. But the other interesting thing is that a lot of times I have friends and family and people I run into who find out what we do, and they'll say, oh, do you make such and such, or have you considered this? And 9 times out of 10, the item is available, but people just don't know where to go to find things. And that is the biggest problem. There is no store. It's not easy to locate things.
Your business is primarily on the Internet. Do you have any bricks and mortar stores?
Yes, we have actually a number of brick and mortar stores. We don't have our own stores. We have a number of brick and mortar stores that sell our items, and they range mm-hmm. from HME, home medical equipment stores, to some gift stores, and they're scattered throughout the country. We also have a number of catalogs that carry our merchandise. We have one catalog in the Netherlands, one catalog in Australia, and then a number of the catalogs here in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
as well as our own online and Amazon.
Yeah, and so is the online business the bulk of your business today?
It's probably about 50-50 between catalogs and, you know, vendors that we deal with. Most of them we've dealt with for quite a few years now, and they order fairly steadily as we introduce new items.
Not intended to be an embarrassing question, because I'm 72 myself. I live in Southwest Florida.
Okay.
On Sanibel Island.
Okay, we're not far from you.
And a researcher that I worked with, who conducts clinical trials with people with dementia, tells me that Lee County is ground zero in the United States with the greatest number of people with dementia and Alzheimer's as a percentage of the population rather than any other part of the country.
Well, that's interesting.
And I asked him the question, and he didn't have any specific research, but I asked you the question. What is the computer and Internet competency of our senior citizens?
Well, having just received 2 letters in the mail today, one with a check and one with a handwritten letter, and at the risk of sounding ageist, a lot of times you can tell by the handwriting
mm-hmm.
how old someone may or may not be. And,
Well,
just in the fact that it's even a handwritten letter tells you something.
Mm-hmm.
Some seniors are very techno-savvy.
Mm-hmm.
And others have children who are very techno-savvy and are looking for items to purchase for their parents or grandparents. And I would say probably more than 50% of our business is not to the end user themselves, but to a family member of the end user.
Mm. Do you think that as the numbers I've seen is that about 10,000 boomers a day are retiring,
right. Mm-hmm.
And will continue, that rate will continue for perhaps as many as 15 years into the future? We're going to be bringing a lot of people into the over 65 age group. As the generation, the younger generation comes through, would you expect them to have more technical savvy than the older part of the generation coming through?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, my mother died 4 or 5 years ago, and she was 86 at the time, and my mother spent a lot of time on the computer. She loved researching things. So I think some of it is just individual preference and accessibility that they may or may not have, and, you know, sheer determination to try to master computers. Some people don't want to touch them at all, and other people embrace them enormously. So it's a very individual thing with regards to seniors. But the population that's entering the senior segment of our population, that number will be much, much more computer savvy, as that computer savvy age group is going to be expanding.
Right. Do you find that the and looking at your website,
mm-hmm.
I get I want to say this the right way. I sense a more female bent to your website. As opposed to more balance between men and women. Is that because women live longer than men and they're the better, bigger customers?
No, I don't think that was not our intention. I think in a lot of respects, women are more accessory oriented when it comes to some things. We have introduced a line of walker bags for men, because men have walkers and wheelchairs too, and they are looking for things to be able to put their phones and their water bottle or their newspaper or whatever into. So in the last 3 years, we have developed a line of bags for men. We have wheelchair blankets. Just in the last 2 weeks, we've gotten in our shipment of charcoal blankets, so we now charcoal gray, so we now have something that's more guy friendly versus the
mm-hmm.
light blue that we had before, and the same thing holds true for the cape that we have. So we're trying to not ignore men. They are a little bit more of, I have 3 sons and a husband and a brother, so I'm familiar with guys.
I have 4 sons.
So it's not as if I'm not aware of the needs that men have. With our napkin clips, we have our adjustable one, we have a brown braided one. We tried to have something that was more guy oriented than
mm-hmm.
Necessarily female. So we try, but sometimes we get it, sometimes we don't, like most things.
Yes.
Dan, we're talking with Joanne Tilleman. She's the founder of Granny Joe, a company that specializes on products to help, people age more gracefully. How's that for
No, that's perfect. That's very good.
Okay. Dan, I'm going to ask Joanne a question. One of the reasons I asked her on the program, we met at a function where you demonstrated your products to a press group in New York City. How did you find that, Joanne? And what do you do? Other things do you do for promotion of your products?
Well, that is the number one question is, how do you get your products and your items in your company, particularly when you're a small business? How do you get them visibility and traction in the marketplace? That particular consumer show in New York, a publicist that I have worked with sent out an email that this group in New York still had places for people, and if you entered, sent them the information, they were giving out 1 free space. So I applied and ended up with a space. And then it was a last-minute dash to get down to New York in 2 days, get to New York with products, that I could easily pack with me and take. And so that's how we ended up there. And actually, the show was good for us. I mean, we got a lot of positive feedback. We've gotten press and visibility since then. So it has been good. But as you said, it's very difficult to how do you figure out where to go to put your dollars for publicity? I have made some advertising investments that didn't turn out to be investments, that turned out to be a hole in the bucket, but that's all part of the learning curve, I try to tell myself. We are selective where we advertise when it comes to print advertising. We do some trade shows where we sell to the end user, and that helps a lot with getting your product out there, because you have people who come back every year. They're looking for you. They know your products. They know the quality of your products. And so they come looking for you, and they've told other people who they know are coming to the show to also come and look for you, and that helps a lot.
Well, Joanne, stop right there. What kind of show is that that you go to year after year?
Well, this past summer I was in Houston, Boston, and then New York, New Jersey metropolitan area. There's a show, it's called the Abilities Expo, and it's for seniors and people who are disabled. That's that particular show. And they also go to Chicago and they go to Los Angeles, but I don't do all of the shows. But that particular show does sell to the end user, and there's a huge market that's being ignored when you consider the disabled and the elderly. They don't have too many opportunities to get together with other people that are really in the same situation they are, particularly the disabled.
Well, what about your social media?
We do Facebook. You have to do Facebook. I'm not savvy enough at this particular point to have really figured out how LinkedIn is going to help me with my business. I suppose it could with regards to access to people who are running or have a high enough profile in assisted living chains or something like that, but that has not really done much for us. We do Facebook ads seasonally as something is warranted. And I also have another, it's Senior Moments with Granny Joe on Facebook, which it's just where I post cartoons about aging, and it's just lighthearted. It's not necessarily driving business to our website. We do have a Granny Joe products Facebook page as well, which we invite people to go to. But it does, and that will tell people where we're going, what trade shows we're going to be attending, and you know where we are, that type of thing. We also do advertising in like VFW magazine, Quest magazine, which is for muscular dystrophy, different targeted print advertising.
Back to you, Dan.
Let me ask you this question.
Sure.
Have you pursued a relationship with AARP?
Well, I'll tell you what. A number of years ago, I approached AARP and was told, and I have not, and it's my fault for not having followed up, and maybe something has changed, but when I first contacted them, probably 6 years ago, they said it was not their demographic. They were looking for active people, active seniors.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that was my reaction. Because even you can be an active senior, but that doesn't mean you don't have someone else in your family, a parent or grandparent or somebody who is not as active as they'd like to be. But that was the response that I got, was that they were targeting active seniors.
Well, they've had a total turnover in their administration this last year. Maybe you should go back after them, Joanne.
I'll try again and see. But I mean, I just saw something last night, and it didn't even say it retired people. It was real possibilities. So they're and if you were looking for a job, they would help you find a job. So it's like they've gotten away from retired people, and they're now helping people with job placement. So but I will follow up and see what happens.
So there are other organizations that cater to seniors that are competitors to AARP. Have you looked at any of those?
I would have to say no, because I'm not familiar with who you might be referring to.
Okay. Well, I think you could AMAT is one. You probably go to the web and find organizations for seniors. It would seem to me, based on the early part of our discussion,
mm-hmm.
that we both agree that this market is a market that's going to grow dramatically over the next 10 to 15 years in terms of the number of people in the segment.
So without a doubt.
It would seem that the business opportunity for you and your products must be phenomenal going forward.
It is.
And
interestingly enough, there's very little competition in the marketplace.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. I wouldn't be surprised. You mentioned your mother spending so much time doing research.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that's I suspect, based on the people that I work with, that was a kind of unique thing for your mom. I don't think that a lot of seniors spend hours and hours and hours researching on the internet. That's why we talked about the next generation, or the
mm-hmm.
the younger part of the baby boomers, are going to be much more tech savvy. But it would just seem to me that as we have talked to over 100, if not more, people that have started businesses built around the internet, that the opportunity for success is dramatic, as is yours. But one of the things that we have noticed that's different about people who start businesses on the internet is that they seem to almost be paranoid about customer service. Are you paranoid about customer service?
Providing quality customer service?
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure I'd say I was paranoid, but we try to respond to everybody within a minimum of 24 hours. We believe in personal attention. I mean, I have a retail background at some point in my life, and I know that customer service, if you're not giving it to somebody, they'll go find somebody who will. So I firmly believe that, and I try to respond accordingly.
That's one of the things that Don and I have noticed in our conversations with people, is that, and I've done it on my own personal experience, is that I hate to go to a mall anymore, because it's almost impossible to find anybody to wait on you. You walk through these caverns of these massive stores, and there's the registers all have a drape over them. There's nobody around, and it's no longer a positive experience. And even go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and they're doing you a favor by taking your money when you finally find somebody.
and even the big box stores, as it relates to hardware, the same way. I was in on Sunday, just trying to find an electrical toggle switch, and there was nobody in the electrical department. And I went mm-hmm. to customer service. I don't think we have that. And so I kept walking and found somebody, and they took it to me. It took me to the place where they had it. So
sure.
It's very frustrating. Very frustrating.
Dan,
could
I jump in and ask a question?
Sure.
Joanne, you have three sons. Are any of them coming into the business, and what are your plans for the future?
Well, Dan was giving his age, and I'm almost the same age.
I'm older than both of you.
I have one son who's in the business. He lives not far from us. It's sort of a strange he was the one who was the global sourcing vice president. He has all the technical expertise with import and all the paperwork and everything that goes with that. The people that we deal with overseas, he's known for over 20 years, and so we did not have to, you know, really struggle to source, and we still don't have to struggle to source products overseas. So that's been a huge assistance to us in growing our business. My other two sons are opposite corners of the country, one in New Jersey and one in Oregon. So they are not in a position to be able to join the business at this particular point in time. Although I had a granddaughter with me in New York, and who knows, maybe she'll decide to move in with us and move along in the business if her interest takes her that way.
Well, did she like it, what she was doing there?
I was really surprised, and I was so proud of her because I had sort of misgivings. I had no idea how she would do at this show, and she stepped right up, and she had no problem explaining features and benefits to people about different products and different things, and I thought, okay, she's a lot more ready than I would have thought. So I was very, very proud of her. She did a great job.
How old is she?
She's almost 16.
Almost 16.
Wow. I'll tell you, she didn't look 16.
Did she look older or younger?
Older. No, she looked older. And she handled herself much better. I would have never thought she was 16.
Yeah, no, she'll be 16 in December. And if she had had her hair down, which goes down to her waist, she would have looked 14 easily. But she had her hair up and looking very mature. So I was very, very, very pleased with her.
So in the time we have left, let me ask you another question. What do you think going forward over the next few years are your biggest challenges?
Well, our biggest challenges are those challenges we've faced from day one, which is where do you go to sell the merchandise? As we know, the market is there. We know the market is growing. But bricks and mortar stores do not see the senior market as anything that they want to invest any floor space to, which could be a mistake for them because seniors are people who still actually go to malls and, you know, they like wandering around and looking. They don't do all of their shopping online, which a lot of millennials do. So maybe that's something that stores will take a look at. We would be thrilled if somebody like Amazon would have a senior section versus putting all senior things into health and wellness. They have a baby section, stores. I mean, you can go into almost any gift store in the country, and they will have a little baby corner of gifts. But they don't do the same thing for seniors. Seniors need to, they're not going to speak up. I mean, it's just a market that retail doesn't embrace, hasn't embraced. And that has been a struggle and will continue to be, will continue to be a struggle until all of a sudden the demographics demand some floor space.
So when you say demographics, you mean the continual expanding that we talked about of the population itself.
Right. Most people do not want to go to hospital supply stores to purchase items. They don't want items that look as though they shopped at the hospital supply store. The HME, the home medical equipment stores that I have merchandise in, the people there have told me that 9 times out of 10, they will somebody will go into the store to pick up whatever it is they need, and the other person's spouse will wait in the car. People just don't want to go into those stores because they're not warm and fuzzy. They're clinical and they're depressing. Maybe HME, DME needs to do something to make their stores a little more inviting, but that's not my job.
Joanne, I have to jump in here. I had to get a boot for my wife. She had an accident with her foot and last week, and I went into two of those stores, and you are so right about what you said. And the worst part about it was the customer service was worse than anything I'd ever run into. So you're absolutely right.
Well, the HME DME business has been that has changed significantly in the last 10 years. Because when we first started our business, when we went to this one medical trade show, if it wasn't Medicare reimbursable, no one wanted to talk to us. As medical as they have gone into much more competitive bidding for wheelchairs, walkers, boots, any of those medical supplies, most of the HME, DME stores have had to drastically increase their retail offerings in order to stay viable. And that's just a big change in that particular market. And a lot of those stores are pushing customer service, although evidently not the one that you went to. But, you know, that's a change in the marketplace in the last 10 to 15 years. From when we were first looking to start a business to now, has been the you've had a big contraction in the a number of HME stores throughout the country, and it's all due to competitive bidding.
Well, you're so right. Well, I have to tell you this. I'm also going to send you a link. Have you heard of noinsurance.com?
I have heard of it.
Well, you really it turns out they're right around the corner from me here in New Jersey. And I ended up, instead of paying $125 for the boot, I paid $75.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what you're saying. We're going to invite him on the program, but I am going to try to send you his information, because you really should talk to him.
Yeah.
He's the smartest guy I've seen in this area.
Yeah, that is a whole market that has changed drastically, like I said, in the last 10 years, and some of it, a lot of it, is government driven.
That's for sure. Dan, we have to call it. It's been a great interview. We've got to call it a day. Joanne, please tell us your website again and where people can.
Sure, it's www.grannyjoeproducts.com.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Well,
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book. Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. Small business funding is easier these days thanks to a new breed of lender called FinTech lenders. These internet-based lenders cut the time between applying for funds and getting the funds to just hours instead of months. They also make it easier to repay your loans, but their costs might be a little higher for their service. The next time you need dollars for your small business, try them. You might like the change. I'm Dan Perkins for Recalculating.biz and your small business tip of the day.
Tom Stewart, Executive Director of the National Center for the Middle Markets, is here to talk about their recent analysis concerning finding and retaining employees. As our listeners well know, that is one of the most difficult parts of leading any company. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be with you.
Tom, let's start by first asking, what is your website and where is this study? Is it available on the website?
Absolutely. Let me give you a little bit of background. The National Center for the Middle Market is a research center at the Fisher College of Business at The Ohio State University. So we're part of Ohio State, and our website is middlemarketcenter.org. And you can go to that website and you will find a number of things on attracting and retaining talent. The most recent one is a project that we just completed with the Brookings Institution called Help Wanted. And but in addition, you can also find stuff, a research paper called Mastering Talent Planning, and also one called Building the Top Team. So there are three of them, but the most recent one, as I said, is this project that we just completed with Brookings called Help Wanted.
Well, having said that, what are some of the findings from the survey that you can share with our audience?
Let me start at the top, which is if you go around and ask companies of all sizes about their biggest challenges right now, you will find that talent tops the list. That's not always the case. It's usually, a pretty seriously important topic. But right now, with the country at almost full employment, with some larger issues about overall workforce participation, how many adults are actually actively participating in or looking for work, what you see is that talent has risen to the number one issue. More than half of companies of all sizes say that attracting and retaining talent is a really serious challenge. And when we looked at our particular focus, which is on mid-sized companies, which is a middle third of the private sector, we found a number of numbers that startled me. And the one that startled me the most is that 4 out of 10 executives say that a lack of talent is constraining their growth. I mean, I could grow more if only I could get the people. And that's a number that really sort of surprises me. I mean, there's a real issue out there, and it's rich and complicated, and it's holding people and companies back.
Supposedly, there's 92 million people, or some such number of people, who are not working, who are not in the workforce. Why aren't they being used as a talent source?
Well, first of all, some of them can't be. All right, some of them are. I mean, there are. There are people who have disabilities. There may be people who choose not to work because they're stay-at-home moms and dads. There may be people who are retired. There's some interesting age questions in some of the workforce stuff. But if you take a look at workforce participation numbers, they are flat and trending a little bit down. I think I can't remember what the number is, but I think that it's like 60% of the available population is actually working or looking to work, and that's a relatively low number. You can look at a number of reasons for it. One is aging, and companies. We do have an aging population. You know, the baby boomers. I'm a boomer. We're sort of hanging on for dear life, but slowly but surely, baby boomers are retiring out of the workforce. So you've got that issue. You've got an issue with education, with a gap between the skills that people have and the skills that jobs require. And so you have a lot of people who are sort of educated out of the market. You have an issue with immigration and with uncertainty in immigration. And, again, if we want to think about how many people are available in the talent pool out there, addressing that is important. Opioids. Brookings, our friends at Brookings did a study and found that as much as 20% of the decline in prime male working population, like, men in their 40s and 50s, may be due to opioids. So that is really hurting. And then there's the gig economy. I call it Uberization. If you go with aging, education, immigration, opioids, and Uberization, the gig economy, you may have a whole lot of people who are dipping doing a little of this and a little of that, and they're driving an Uber, they're driving a Lyft, or they're doing various other things in the gig economy, and more contractors out there who are sort of part-time working. They're sort of in the informal economy and doing stuff that is enough for them, but they're not really contributing as much as they could or as much certainly as employers would want. So there's a big macroeconomic thing. But then there are a whole lot of problems that companies are creating for themselves, and opportunities, therefore, that companies have to solve those problems for themselves.
Dan, it's up to you.
Welcome, Tom. I'd like to start kind of at the grassroots here. Why don't you tell our audience what you mean when you say middle market?
Yeah, happy to do that. There are a lot of different definitions of that, and people in government tend to define mid-sized in terms of number of headcount. People in financial services companies tend to define middle market in terms of what fits their business model. When we started out with the National Center for the Middle Market 6 years ago, we said the middle market is the middle third of the private sector. What's that? And if you take a look at private GDP and you figure out, you know, what's a third, a third, a third, the middle third corresponds to companies with annual revenues between $10 million and $1 billion. And those guys, that group is about 200,000 companies, contribute a third of private GDP and employ about a third of private sector employees. So that's sort of the middle third. Now, having said that, that's a big spread. 10 million to a billion is two orders of magnitude. But these companies are bigger than small, and they're smaller than big. They're not startups. Their average age is, their median age is 31. And within the middle market, we sort of subdivide it into 10 to 50, 50 to 100, and 100 and 100 to a billion to sort of to get some variation on size and get some analysis. But that's how we define it.
I'm curious about that because our listeners are part of what we call small business. And if you look at the vast majority of the corporations in the private sector, there are less than 50 people, and they employ millions and millions of people, and they represent maybe as much as 80% of the total corporations in the United States. So they
But not 80% of the output. Yeah, but not 80% of the output. And if you look at that, you see the thirds divide roughly as that. And also, you know, a lot of those millions of and they are millions of very small corporations may include somebody's subchapter S corporation. So my wife and I have a corporation because we both do freelance writing and she does it as a career. And so, you know, we have an S corp that manages that. And, you know, and at the same time I work for the Ohio State University. So it's you get some I wouldn't call it double counting because it's not double counting, but you get some numbers that are a little different. And, you know, what's interesting is a lot of these talent issues, and show up, pretty early in companies. I mean, once you start growing, once you start adding workers and maybe then start growing some departments. I got a marketing department. I got a finance department. Once you start doing that, you start entering into this problem of planning, managing, and attracting talent because it's not just, you know, the family or the six of us who started out in business school together and created this little company or our drinking buddies. You know, once you start doing that, you begin to raise these challenges about finding the talent you need and then developing the talent to keep it growing as you grow.
When you think about this middle market and what you're reporting is significant shortage of human resources, if they aren't there, if we basically are close, as you said, to full employment, where will corporations get the body count in order to fill the spots that they need?
Well, let me. You know, I mentioned earlier that there are a lot of things that companies can do and can do better on their side of the talent equation. One of the things that we found is that smaller companies tend to be very reactive. When it comes to talent, let me explain what I mean by that. One of the things that we've learned is that they don't go looking for talent unless and until they've got an opening. So they're not out there sort of building or filling what HR people call a talent pool. They're sort of dealing in the spot market. Hey, I need a truck driver. Let me go find a truck driver. I need, you know, a web designer. Let me go find a web designer. And they're waiting until they have something. So they're being reactive. At the same time, when it comes to developing the talent they've got, about half of these companies do not train on a regular basis. They only train when needed, and most of the training they provide is training in company policies. So they're going out and saying, I want somebody, but I want him or her to be fully formed, fully made, plug and play, ready to start on day one, and they're not developing internally. Here's a number that really surprised me. 65% of job openings in small and mid-sized companies are filled by going outside, and only 35% are filled by promotion from within. The other thing that they're not doing is they're not connecting with workforce resources like community colleges. They're not doing internships. They're not connecting with workforce improvement boards. Again, the percentages are pretty striking, and this is from 10 million to a billion, so it includes some fairly large companies. 70% say that they have no such collaborative relationships at all. Now, that's not entirely their fault, because some of these organizations are not optimized to deal with smaller companies. You know, BMW comes into town and says, I want 50 welders. They say, aye, aye, sir, and they get them 50 welders, right? But if 20 smaller companies say they want 5 each, you know, which is be 100, the community college has a harder time responding to that. It's more complicated. But the companies are not doing enough, could be doing more to find talent, develop it, roll their own, rather than rely on a tough spot market. There's another thing that they're doing, which is, think about it this way. People listening to this show, you know, we could fill a whiteboard easily with what it's like to work for Google, or what it's like to work for IBM, or what it's like to work for Procter & Gamble. I mean, these big companies have very big employer brands. I mean, not only big consumer brands or customer brands, but they have big brands as employers, so we know what it's like. But what's it like to work for Jenny's Ice Cream in Columbus, Ohio? What's it like to work for Mesa Industries in Cincinnati, Ohio? Who's ever heard of these companies? Overhead Door Company, or my favorite company, Kegworks, which is America's biggest maker of bar rails. What's it like? You know, what is the brand of these companies? And smaller companies can do a much better job of finding what their employer brand is and projecting it in their community or in their industry, and B, of developing what is called an employee value proposition, which is, why do I work here aside from just the pay? You know, what's in it for me aside from however much I'm going to pay? What's in terms of culture, in terms of promotion, in terms of opportunity to advance, in terms of what it's like to work here? So those two areas are areas where companies can do a lot more to become more attractive. And then those areas that I mentioned earlier are areas where companies can do a lot more to become more proactive. So, gosh, I didn't realize I was going to do that, but you could rhyme it, right? Become more attractive and become more proactive are really two ways that companies can start taking charge of this talent problem.
I'm born and raised in Columbus, Ohio. The most important thing I want to hear out of this call today, what's going on with my Buckeyes?
Well, OH, right? Well, I tell you right now, it is a I think it's 3 games in a row that the Bucks have scored more than 50 points. So, the next big game, I think the Bucks have a bye this week, and next week, week after that, it's Ohio State versus Penn State, and that's going to be a pretty big game.
Is that home or away?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know the answer to that question.
All right.
But I got to tell you, it's a lot of fun when the national championship game was on TV a couple of years ago. I mean, watching that game in a sports bar was a hoot because you know, normally you go to a sports bar and they got 20 screens and they're on 20 different games, right?
Yeah.
But not that night.
Not in Columbus.
Not in Columbus.
All right. Thank you. Let's go back to the important subject.
I thought we were on the important subject.
Well, that's true. It's hard to go back to reality after you're talking about the Buckeyes. But anyway, I was one of the 87,000 people possible who could. I watched every home game that Archie Griffin played in his career at Ohio State. But that,
oh, wow.
That's something else. Anyway.
Careful,
what I'm
Dan, that dates you.
Yeah, I know. I don't mind. You know, he was a two-time high school trophy winner. He was a phenomenal athlete and a great person, a great human being, too. So thinking about great human beings, if companies have to go outside, and I want to use the industry that I'm in. I manage money, and I have been independent since 1989, but prior to that, I worked on Wall Street, and I worked at Merrill Lynch and a couple other places. And there are times in the market cycle where the brokerage firms would rather go out and try and recruit brokers from other firms than to try and train their own, because they got almost instant productivity as opposed to waiting for. And the same thing could be true in the private sector, what you're talking about. Doesn't it make sense to go out if you have a need and you don't have anybody that you can clearly identify who could possibly grow into that potential? You need, as you said, they're reacting instantaneously. They need somebody they can put to work that can be productive immediately. So isn't that the logical thing that they're going to do, is go out and buy talent?
And the answer to that is you should do all of the above, right? You know, there are real advantages to promoting from within, because people know the system, they know the company, they know the team, they know how things work. There was a really interesting Harvard Business Review study a few years ago by a guy named Boris Groysberg called "The Risky Business of Hiring Stars," and it actually looked at your old business, and it looked at what happened when an investment bank would hire some superstar, you know, from Goldman to Morgan or Morgan to Goldman or whatever, and they would find that the superstar did less well when repotted in a different garden, because they didn't know the system, they didn't know the culture. The superstar actually is always part of a constellation of other people who may shine less brightly, but there's a team. So there are real advantages in that, in promoting from within. At the same time, I mentioned earlier that these companies do not do a good enough job of looking for talent when they don't need it. So that's that whole talent pooling thing. If you are constantly on the lookout saying, I know there's going to come a time when I need some kind of worker, this kind or that kind or more than one, if you're constantly working that equation and you're going to the conferences and you're meeting the people and you're passing out your business cards and say, hey, give me a call one day, you know, let's have lunch, keeping in touch, that can really work. I met a woman in Atlanta a couple of years ago who head of HR for a small software company. And one of the things she told me that was really interesting, she said, I need Stanford IT computer science graduates, and I can't get them because they all go to Google. But when they have kids, I can get them because then they want a better work-life balance, and I can offer that. So my job is to make sure that I know where they are when I need them. And so that company does various social events. They do do events so that they're keeping in touch with potential talent. And there are a lot of things that companies can do that way. Another company, very different industry, in upstate New York, in Albany, New York, a company called Simmons Machine Tools, which is a really interesting company that makes all kinds of highly complicated technology. One of the things they do is they have this technology that measures railroad rails to make sure they stay parallel, very sophisticated stuff. They need to let their company's name be known in the region because people have never heard of Simmons Machine Tools. So they do a bunch of stuff with local community colleges and things like this. But they also, every summer, they put on a car show. Just they get a bunch of cars and park them out in front of in the parking lot around the office to attract mechanically minded kids who want to come and poke at the cars. And they say, hey, come on in and take a look at our offices. And they just get themselves known. So it's both. You know, you really want to develop people because that's a really valuable thing. And that means also if people see a career path, they're harder to steal. You're less likely to lose them. So you want to develop, but you also want to be constantly out there examining the market so that if you need somebody, it actually happens to be somebody you already know and who already knows you.
I was, John, Don said, you know, that I was dating myself when I was talking about working for Merrill Lynch and 25 years ago. But when I started in Merrill Lynch, I started as a broker in Columbus, Ohio, and was drafted to go to New York and work in a product area. But at the same time, Merrill Lynch had what they call a JET program, a junior executive trainee program, where they had people, full-time recruiters, who would go out on the college campuses and look at business majors, not for any particular department at Merrill Lynch or division, but people who had basic fundamental skills that could be adapted. And they brought them in.
Let's find a good athlete, and we can teach them whatever we can teach them. Yeah.
Right. And they abandoned it because it was too expensive in their mind. It was too expensive. It was cheaper for them to go out and buy talent. I don't know, do big corporations, I would assume that people like Google and Microsoft, or maybe I shouldn't, but do they have training programs for new executives?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think that in general, a lot of these sort of programs where they hire you and then they put you 6 months here, 6 months there, 6 months there, and they give you sort of a rotation like a medical student. I think a lot of those have gone away because you're not adding any value at that time, and it's probably better to hire somebody who really knows marketing and then eventually broaden broaden their capabilities rather than try to rotate them around like that.
Your center is located in what school at Ohio State?
In the business school, the Fisher College of Business.
So Fisher is John Fisher from Nationwide Insurance.
No, it's Max Fisher.
Max Fisher.
Max Fisher, who I can't remember. I'm going to get shot for brand noncompliance. I can't remember what his industrial background, but it's the Max M. Fisher School of Business.
Okay. Nationwide was a large institutional. Anyway,
it is a very large Columbus employer. Yep.
Yeah. We've been talking about
Well, I'm
going to
break in this Buckeye day and say we've been talking with Tom Stewart, Executive Director of the National Center for the Middle Markets. Tom, your website again?
It's middlemarketcenter.org. Middlemarketcenter.org.
Thank you so much, Tom, for being with us
today.
Thank
you, sir.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. How is your vision? I'm not talking about your eyesight, but rather can you see the changes coming in your business or industry? The ability to see what's coming can give you an edge over your competition. Industry magazines can be a great help to see changes coming to your business. You get the magazines because you belong to a group. Use the resource of your group or association to keep yourself current. You're paying for it anyway, why not use this resource? If you keep yourself abreast of what's happening, you will be able to make the changes to enhance your opportunity to grow your business. So here's your recalculating.biz small business tip of the day. The next time you get one of those membership magazines in the mail, sit down and read it cover to cover. You just might uncover a new opportunity. I'm Dan Perkins from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.